And a good Saturday morning to you. Welcome in to another edition of Ask the Experts. I'm your host, Dave Callender. Thanks so much for joining us for 2 hours of informative radio with your questions answered. And back for another gray and rainy Saturday morning, the perfect day to stay in and just listen to the radio. It's Kevin Power and Ann Turner from Power Mortgages.
And a very good morning to you, Dave.
And welcome back to the show.
Don't you feel like maybe this should be the long weekend? The weather's so miserable. Looks like it should be the 24th of May long weekend.
Well, I'm hoping the 24th of May long weekend looks much different than this.
I am too, but a lot of 24th of May weekends look like this, and maybe we're going to get it out of our system and have a beautiful long weekend.
That would be good.
Yeah,
it would I really hope so. On the show today, we are going to be talking about the issue of bad credit. We're going to explore the causes and the cures. A lot of people really don't understand that the things that they do in daily life are either creating good credit or bad credit. And, a little habit of paying the credit card a day later, too. That does add up. People do notice. Letting the limits on the cards keep getting higher and higher, that can have an effect on your rating. So what are the small things that every credit consumer should pay attention to, and what are the big ones? Once you're in a mess and your credit rating has gone down in flames, what can you do to improve it? And how long should it take for lenders to like you again, to really, really like you? Well, we'll find all that on the show today. And throughout the hour, if you've got questions for Kevin and Ann, do give us a call at 519-570-2545. Out of town, toll free at 1-800-570-5715 or *570, hands-free on your cell phone. But first, we're going to take a look at what's been going on in the news. And I know Ann's got a couple of topics she wants to tackle, so take it away. What's bugging you this weekend?
Well, there are two really big news stories this week in the financial sector. One relates very directly to our business, and that's mortgage fraud. Bank of Montreal came out this week with a story about fraud cases that involved hundreds of people and up to $40 million. And also noticed at the same time that this fraud wasn't just with them, but went across something like 26 different lending firms as well. Now, none of these other 26 lending firms have stepped out and said, oh, yeah, you know, we've had some severe losses as well. But involved in this, BMO says, is something like 17 lawyers, mortgage brokers, and even four of their own staff. I'd like to suggest it's probably more than four of their own staff. Our own personal history with lenders we've seen a lot of fraud initiated at branch level. Our own personal opinion is that it's from pressure dealt to the employees there from head office. But a lot of it as well has stemmed from greed, and we're talking about in our own area, not outside the area. And we've often seen banks acknowledge within our industry, or we know they acknowledge someone is creating fraud, but they don't ever warn each other of that particular person. I mean, there's been brokers that we know and have always known are less on the up and up. And one lender had five files of his, and out of the five, four of them were fraudulent, and yet they never went out and told other lenders. I queried them if they were warning other lenders that this particular broker, you know, was creating a lot of fraudulent files, and they said no. Banks really are very secretive about misadventures of this kind. They want the appearance, I guess, of everything's fine, nothing's going wrong. They aren't experiencing any losses from crime, inside or outside of their institution, but in fact, it really is quite an issue. And I'm glad to see that BMO has stepped out and said, you know what, we have had a lot of losses here from this group over a long period of time, and some of it exists outside and some of it exists inside of our own firm.
This is a second sting for Bank of Montreal in as many years. There was a court case about a year ago involving two of its former employees out in the British Columbia area, where there was collusion and mortgage fraud between the two of them, where the branch manager of one of their branches was referring mortgages to their mobile mortgage specialist, and they were splitting the commission between the two of them. So that one's still before the courts, and it just shows that there is always something in the wind. There's always something going on, and these things very seldom ever become to the forefront. I think probably with PR being the main situation on it, and I guess the lack of seriousness that we have seen over the years in front of the courts on white collar crime, and it's very difficult to get people to prosecute, investigate, and really I guess take people to task for some of the activities that have happened in the past as well.
But the thing about this is an issue that we have always had, and that issue is when people have access to too many aspects of a deal, the opportunity for fraud increases. And that fraud very seldom happens with just one person doing it. It needs the collusion of different people at different levels to do it. And in this case, there was inside collusion with their own workers. There were lawyers. There probably were appraisers. There were straw buyers. There were people who created fraudulent documents, and there's a whole industry out there that creates fraudulent documents. And there were mortgage brokers and probably appraisers as well that were doing this. But one of the problems where appraisers weren't involved in this particular scam is that they relied on Emily, which is a computer-generated program that gives a range of value in a certain neighborhood. They take the postal code and say the houses within this postal code are worth in this range. But nobody ever goes out and looks at the house and says, yeah, but this house isn't at the top end of that range. It's at the bottom end of this range. And that's what they were doing, was convincing the bank that the houses were actually at the top end of the range, not the bottom end of the range, buying it for the lower price and mortgaging it for the higher price. Mm-hmm. And then the money was going out of country to India, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Lebanon. So I'm just wondering where that eventually ended up. But
there was $70 million of mortgages that were identified, and they actually started working on this in 2006. So this has been approximately 4 years coming to the forefront, I guess, where people were actually being charged and this information being released to the public. And it just kind of shows you how long it takes to really move some of these files forward. They are expecting that their losses are going to be somewhere in the vicinity of $40 million that they're going to lose on this portfolio as a result of these overvalued properties and being over mortgaged for more than a realistic value.
Wow. It's incredibly surprising to me that, A, anyone thinks they could actually get away with this, because if there's anything on this earth that leaves a huge paper trail, I would think it would be arranging a mortgage. I mean, there's paper and paper and paper. How do you not think eventually you won't be found out? Well, why even bother? But secondly is, why does it take so long for the banks to catch on and then, you know, investigate and follow up?
It really only comes to the forefront, Dave, when payments stop being made. And so long as payments are being made and property values continue to increase, these things go by very far and large without detection. And it's only when you end up in a default situation and all of a sudden you have to get an appraisal done for power of sale purposes and you find out it's $300,000 less than the appraisal you had done a year or 2 years ago, and then people ask questions, well, what the heck did happen? Why such a difference in the value? Particularly if there hasn't been a change in market values with a steep decline in values. And that's usually when they find out. It's only when payments stop coming in. And that's been typical. And I've worked in this industry for many decades with a couple of stints working in internal audit with a consumer finance company that I worked with for quite a few years. And the MO that seems to run pretty standard through people who perform these types of frauds and transactions is that they're always smarter than somebody else. And they never think they're going to get caught because they are smarter. And it's usually coincidence that causes these things to come to the forefront. Somebody picks something up and it just doesn't quite look right, and you just investigate it a bit further, and you find out that you got a huge problem.
But it's getting that attention first. But the other problem, I think, is the reluctance to prosecute white-collar crime because of the attention it brings to the lender when it happens. I mean, there's a huge public eye on BMO right now because of this huge market fraud. But it is once again, in our company, we don't hire people that are in other aspects of the real estate industry for the very reason that it just makes it too much more easy to create a fraudulent deal if you're controlling more than just one aspect of it. If you have only one aspect of it that you can control and you're unable to control the other people involved in this deal, because last time we were on, we did talk about how many people are involved in a real estate transaction. There's a large number of them. Mm-hmm. And the more of those people that you have in control of the deal, the easier it is for you to create a fraudulent transaction. So our policy is you do mortgages and you don't do anything in a similar field that would allow you to control more than just the mortgage aspect. It's a way of keeping a distance and clean hands, us making sure that we have clean hands on every deal and we aren't giving anybody else an opportunity to create a fraudulent deal. Greed is a terrible thing, and you see it happening in a lot of places where you wouldn't expect to see it, but it does happen. And to have your head in the sand and say, no, I don't think it will, we don't have fraud going on in our company. Don't expect we ever will. But that's the same attitude that a lot of brokers take. So as a preventative measure, we say we do one thing. We do mortgages, and our agents do mortgages solely, so that temptation isn't there and our trust isn't misplaced.
We've actually had personal experience on seeing some wrongdoing mortgage applications where we were somewhat involved with the applicants and have made a point to call the financial institutions that were actually funding these things and brought the irregularities to their attention. Surprisingly, the response that we got was pretty well, mind your own business. They just didn't want to hear what we were saying and what was going on in the file. And this is a personal phone call I made to one of the audit departments of one of the major chartered banks in Canada. And that is the response that I got.
Well, there you go. So it makes you wonder why you even bother trying, but at least you know you did the right thing. And that's good to know as well. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, do we have got any other news to cover?
Yeah, we'll just do a little bit on
We'll
stock
do a little
market.
Bit more news, and then we'll get to our topic today, which is your credit. Issues of bad credit, good credit, and how you make sure that the good credit doesn't become bad. My guest today, Kevin and Ann Power from Power Mortgages, 519-886-1993, and online at powermortgages.ca. I called you Ann Power. I just realized that.
You're going to pay for that, Dave.
Oh, dear. Kevin Power and Ann Turner from Power Mortgages. Online at powermortgages.ca. If I survive the break, we'll be back with more of Ask the Experts here on 570 News. Welcome back to the show. I'm Dave Callender. My guests, Kevin Power and Ann Turner from Power Mortgages. Online at powermortgages.ca. And before we get back into what's going on in the news, we'll give Kevin a chance to tell us all about this week's rate specials.
All right, Dave, thanks. And never had to beat me up too badly this week. And actually, we do have lower interest rates than we did 2 weeks ago when we did our last show. Current five-year rate, 4.35%, and that's with a 90-day closing. We do have 4.5% for 120-day closing. Variable rate mortgages at prime less 0.50%. Prime today is at 2.25%, so 1.75% on a variable rate mortgage until rates change. 7-year term at 4.90%, and 10-year fixed term mortgages at 5.55%. Those are subject to change at any time, and also for new customers only.
And if you'd like to take advantage of those rates, give Kevin a call right after the show at 519-240-2967. That's 240-2967. So also of note in the news this week,
it is this wild ride Thursday in the stock market. Now, Thursday, for 1/2 hour between 2:40 and 3:10 p.m., the stock market just plummeted. And like one stock went from $59 to 8 cents. Another stock went from $6 to 1 penny. And it was worldwide. And what they're looking at and thinking about now is it was because of computers and the involvement of institutions like pension plans and stuff like that, mm-hmm. that there was a trigger built into the computer programs. When this happens and that happens, sell, you know, orders. Or when this or that happens, buy. You know, in one case, over 27,000 stocks were sold at a penny. That's, now, how do you go from $6 at $2.40 to a penny at $3.10? And the huge losses that happened because of that. A few years ago when I was in school getting my broker's license, one of the courses I had to take is the course that financial planners have to take. Mm-hmm. Financial planners only have to take one course, and I had to take that one course towards the 14 courses for my broker's license. And I was required to write a paper on the stock market and where we were in the cyclical cycle of the stock market. And out of my class of 40 people, I was made fun of by my prof, but did get an A+ on my paper, that we weren't anywhere in the cycle. It was hard to say where we were going to be, and it would be hard to predict where we were because things had changed and had changed in a way that economists haven't caught up with. And one of the ways that made the change is type of investors that were now in the stock market. And we're in the stock market because of the computer. And that sees day traders and people like myself or like you who have opened up these accounts at lenders who got out of the lending, not out of the lending business, but added the stock market to their business. And you can make a trade for a few dollars very inexpensively, less than it takes money it takes to hire a stockbroker. And so you go in with no real knowledge of the market or the market cycle or anything like that, but you can still trade. And the market becomes volatile because someone will send out a rumor that will affect a stock. You will read this rumor on the internet, and you'll buy or sell according to this rumor that is sent out by someone who, out of greed, has a personal interest in making money on that stock. But also now, because of these programs by other institutional investors that aren't stockbrokers, but institutions who set arbitrary guidelines for triggering buys and sells, rather than having human judgment there. Mm-hmm. You know, any human who was triggering, looking at these sales would say, just a minute, something weird's happening here. Let's not do this massive sale. But once the computers got on it, it happened. And when you have these things having such a huge influence on the stock market, you're no longer able to accurately predict what's going to happen. And I think economists are going to have to start looking around and saying, developing different models, because there are new players like individual stock market movers and shakers, like the average Canadian who wants to take their own portfolio into their hands and not pay a broker, or large institutions who trigger these big buys and sells at certain points in the market. And how that, I think, relates to real estate is that we're seeing a similar thing happen, that things are happening in real estate that never happened before. And one of those things that bothers me is these real estate agents that list a property under in order to create a bidding war. And then a house's true market value is never shown, so it attracts buyers that could not afford that house to begin with and puts them in a position of a buying war, bidding war. And people should not be in bidding wars. They should not be doing stupid things like making videos and sending it to the vendors of the property, trying to encourage them to pick them over other people. This is a marketplace where true market value should be met, and it's not being met when it's being artificially jigged around with by lower prices and bidding wars. It should be floating on its own where a house is being sold without that kind of pressure on the vendor or the purchaser. And this is a new element being brought into the real estate market of late, and I hate to see it. So it seems that all of the financial industries are being affected by new methods of manipulating whatever part of the financial market it is, without regard to its effect on everybody as a whole to the benefit of a few.
Well, it's those dang computers. It's all about the computer.
It actually has more to do with greed.
It's the electronic version of my puppy dog ate my homework.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a combination. Computers make greed much faster.
And easier. Well, and the truth of it is, in our business, is that computers have allowed fraudsters to create documentation that is so realistic that it escapes for a very long time due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, people couldn't have created some of the documents that are out there now without the assistance of a computer. I mean, you can virtually print money that will pass for a long time on a computer without due diligence being done to it.
Apparently, I'm not using my computer right. I'm going to have to look into that. My guest today on Ask the Experts, Kevin Power and Ann Turner from Power Mortgages, online at powermortgages.ca and in the real world at 69 Regina Street North in Waterloo. Stick around. More of Ask the Experts coming up here on 570 News. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dave Callender, my guest this hour on Ask the Experts, Kevin Power and Ann Turner from Power Mortgages, where knowledge and service make the difference. You'll find them online at powermortgages.ca. And on to today's topic as we start to discuss credit, bad credit, good credit, how to turn bad credit into good credit, and how your good credit became bad credit. It's, you're not always really aware of all the little things you do that can have, over time, a really, really big impact on your credit score. So I guess the first thing that's kind of a mystery to some people is the whole the credit report that people can call up. And when someone sees my credit report, what is it exactly that they see on it?
There are actually two credit reporting agencies in Canada, the largest and the one that's most used by consumers and as well as credit lenders is Equifax, and the other one is TransUnion. And some of the major lenders subscribe to the services of TransUnion, and we, as well as most other companies, subscribe to Equifax. There are many components that determine, or I guess help determine, a decision in a credit granting situation, whether it's for mortgages, for car loans, car leases, personal loans, or whatever, credit being one of them. And that one, after almost four decades of working in the financial services industry, always seems to be the one that's always carries the most weight. Getting a good credit history requires effort and being astute in the management of your day-to-day financial affairs. Getting a bad credit rating doesn't require an awful lot of effort at all. Just either bad circumstances or unfortunate things befall you during your lifetime, or just having a very lackadaisical attitude towards certain things, and making your payments on time, or just making some really bad, uninformed decisions. And this is one that we seem to see a lot with very young people who are friends for a period of time and decide to share living accommodations, and then all of a sudden something happens, somebody is moving out, and the utilities are in the name of the person that's departing. And so instead of taking the proper steps to change the billing information for who is responsible for the Rogers cable and Bell Canada telephone bill and utilities, and is leaving up to their friends or the remaining people in the property to become responsible for those bills. They don't pay them. Who do they come back on? It's the person that left the house 6 months ago or a year ago, and all of a sudden you get some unfortunate derogatory information in your credit file that's going to stay around for about 6 years and cause you major grief in terms of either getting financing in the future or getting financing at the best rates that are available out in the marketplace.
Now, how we find this information out is that when you come to our office or you go someplace to get a loan of any nature, the person interviewing you will ask you for your social insurance number, and they should ask you for your permission to pull a credit bureau report. But I personally have had a credit bureau report pulled, even though I was assured it wouldn't be. But I'm pretty confident that if you're giving up your social insurance number when you're out looking for credit, a credit bureau report will be pulled.
Mm-hmm.
That is this credit bureau report, the Equifax or the TransUnion report, that creates a document that shows every bit of your credit history. It shows what credit cards you have, what balance you have on each of those credit cards, what your limit, your credit limit is on that credit card, what loans, consumer loans you have out that have regular payments, what their balances are. It shows...
It'll show the number of times that you've made your payments on time, and it'll also show, I guess even more importantly, the number of times that you've been late, whether you've been 30 days late on a payment or 60 days.
How many times you've been late, 30, 60, or 90 plus days late.
And I guess sometimes the big question is, well, what is the definition of being 30 days late? From a creditor's perspective, they issue a bill to you today that's due for payment on the 1st of June. Do you become 30 days late if you don't make your payment until June the 2nd? And the answer on that one is no, you're 1 day late. Mm-hmm. However, if you don't make your payment by July the 1st, when the next payment is due, then you are actually 30 days late. You can even make your payment up until the 29th day, so long as it gets to the creditor on time, and it will not show as a late payment. But as soon as you go 1 day over that 30 days billing cycle, it then will show up in your credit file that you were 30 days late on the payment for that particular month, and that item will stay in your file for 6 years.
And this is something that's easy to create. You can be away on holidays, and you get your bill, and you've missed your payment, or it gets lost and shuffled under a bunch of stuff, or it just simply doesn't get delivered. The bill doesn't ever arrive at your door. It gets lost in the mail. And you aren't even aware that this bill should be there. And it's really, you know, in our busy lives, it's sometimes hard to keep track of when to expect a bill in. You know you've made purchases on the card, but 30 days passes in a hurry, and you don't even think about it. And now that bill has not arrived, and you have not paid it, you've simply forgotten it, moved on to many other things. And you end up being 30 days late for a bill that you misplaced, never received, or simply didn't pay because you were away somewhere else, like on holidays.
Mm-hmm. We've even seen cases where people will pay off the entire balance off their credit card from the month statement that comes in, you know, maybe a day late by the time that they process the payment. But in their mind, they have paid the credit card in full. And the next month, the bill comes in the mail. Don't even open it up, throw it in the garbage, or throw it in a shredder. And because they never open it up, they didn't realize that there's now a $50 or $100 balance left owing on the credit card balance because of accrued interest that happened as a result of paying it 1 day late. And after you don't open that bill up for a period of 30, 60, or 90 days, all of a sudden that whole thing will now start showing up as late payments in your file and negatively impact your credit score and your credit rating.
And this is where computers come in again. A lot of us do our banking, our bill paying by computer. And if you think that if your bill is due on May 10th and you make that payment on May 8th or 9th or 10th and feel that you've made it in time, forget it. You haven't. It takes anywhere from 4 to 6 days to be sure that that creditor receives that payment and is able to acknowledge that you have made that payment. So if your bill is due on the 10th of May, I suggest you get it paid by the 5th, mm-hmm, to be sure. Otherwise, in their books, they haven't received the payment, and you haven't paid, and you are now late, and you're going to bear the interest charges.
I know from experience. I haven't been late, but it's honestly completely luck of the draw. Sometimes I have at the end of the month, I get my Amex bill, I pay it, and 3 days go by before I get the email notification saying we got the payment. And then some months I pay it the next day. I've got a notification going, thanks so much for paying things. It's like, How come it took one day this time and 3 days the last time? So you can never be sure.
And it can be up to 4 to 6 days, you know, to be sure that that payment has been received. So, a good policy is to pay it several days in advance of its due date, or it can be considered late.
Okay. So we've learned that all of our creditors, they report this stuff to the credit bureaus. It's on the report. If you do something naughty, it's on there for 6 years, apparently. Not very forgiving. So obviously, if you're 30 days late or more, that's something that's going to look bad on this report. What else looks bad on your credit report?
You know, 30-day late doesn't look bad. But a number of 30 days late or a consistency of 30 days late looks bad. 90 or 120 days, one of them doesn't look that good. But, you know, a person who is very good at reading credit reports, and I must say Kevin is really good at it.
I've only had a couple of weeks of experience on reading them, though.
Can create a story from that credit report that goes back many years. He can look at his client and say, I'm looking at your credit report, and it looks like you made a move in this year. And it looks like something happened in your family, you know, maybe a divorce or a death or an illness, or you were unemployed in this year, and then you got it together at this time. And because the credit report actually shows you such a long history, often longer than the 6 years, that tells the person who's very adept at it what life events seem to be happening to that person in that time.
Mm-hmm. Like your credit history in terms of, we call them trade lines. If you have a credit card, in my particular case, I got one credit card that goes back to 1978. So you got 32 years of history on one credit card. It doesn't report the payment history for the 38 years or 32 years that I've had it. But it will show that I've had the card since that period of time, and it will show the payment history as well as the limit on any balances on it during the last 6 years. So the credit reports will show your address information, and that's part of what we look and what lenders look at, because when you apply for credit and you provide people your name, your birth date, your social insurance, your employment information, as well as your address information, that information actually gets downloaded into Equifax. If you go in the next week and you give a different birth date, or if you happen to transpose, or the person who's taken the information and keyed it into a computer system transposes a number, it'll send up a warning signal on your credit bureau report. Or if you give a different address, it'll show that your address as of this date, let's say for the sake of argument, May 2010, showed it to be 123 ABC Street. In June, you go in and apply for credit somewhere else, and now you're living at 324 on CDE Street. Mm-hmm. It'll show that that there was an address change on your credit report within the last 30 days.
Just common with students, back and forth between mom and dad and university. And it doesn't say there, this is a student moving back and forth, but that student may have applied for credit in the university town, but went home over the summer and applied for credit again. And every time you apply for credit, it shows up on the report. And if you are applying too often, that is not favorable on your report either. You're considered a credit seeker, mm-hmm. and that's not a good thing. Another bad thing is to have too much credit available to you, whether or not you use it. Now, people will have lines of credit worth 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, several thousands, tens of thousands of dollars available to them. It doesn't matter if they haven't used even one red cent of it. You're considered having that available to you, so you could use it. And then you might have a credit card that's worth $5, $10, $15, $20, or $30,000, a credit limit on that. You may have two or three cards like this. So now you have access to hundreds of thousands of dollars of credit, and that isn't good, because if something happened and you started using up all of this credit, you could be in a sad mess, and that's what creditors are looking at.
Fortunately, and based on what Ann's saying, there's very few creditors actually out there that will interpret that information in that fashion. And by that I mean, They will factor into your calculating your debt service ratios based on the limits of credit that you have available to you and not at balances owing. And what I'm going to say for the financial institutions who do business that way, thank you very much, and I hope that you continue to carry that policy forward, because I've made a lot of money over the years of placing mortgages for people with other financial institutions where that is a non-issue. They basically make the decision on balances. If you have a zero balance, they couldn't care less what your limit is. What it denotes to them is that you have the ability to manage your affairs. You have access to a lot of credit, but you must manage your affairs properly, because if you don't owe any money on it. So it really gets down to the lender. Some lenders that is an issue with, but by far and large, that is a non-issue. They base their decision on credit limits owing or credit balances owing and not the limits that are available.
We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take a look at what makes your credit score look good, because that's what we want. We want an attractive credit score. And is everything on a report true and accurate? And if it's not, what can you do to make it true and accurate? So stick around. And if you've got questions for Kevin and Ann, do give us a call at 519-570-2545, out of town toll free at 1-800-570-5715. Or hands-free on your cell phone, it's star 570. My guests, Kevin Power and Ann Turner from Power Mortgages, give them a call at 519-886-1993. More of Ask the Experts coming up here on 570 News. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Dave Callender. My guests, Kevin Power and Ann Turner from Power Mortgages, where knowledge and service make the difference, online at powermortgages.ca. And just before we get back to the rate specials, let's take a phone call. Henry is calling in from Guelph. Hi there, Henry. You're on 570 News.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
Good. I have just wanted to make a comment with respect to getting your credit ratings, which I do pretty much annually, and I don't have a credit issue. I just wanted to make sure my records are clear. And I have two frustrations. One is the credit agencies oftentimes still have a listing of credit cards that you haven't owned for years. For example, I have an Eaton's card, which obviously doesn't exist. And when I call them to correct the information, they tell me, well, you have to get in touch with the whoever's provided the card in order to get it canceled. Well, I'm dealing with organizations that don't exist anymore, and so it stays on your records forever.
All right.
My second issue is I have some credit that I used with banks, mortgages, that type of thing, going back 8 or 10 years. And suddenly it appeared on my records. And so, I got in touch with the agency and said, look, I haven't had this for many years. And they said, well, the banks haven't cleared this off. So I went to the banks that I originally had the credit with and said, look, I'd like this removed. And the branch that I went to said, well, it's so old, we don't keep the records here that long. Why are you worried? Your credit is good. And I said, well, I'd like it stroked from my records. And they said, there's nothing we can do about it.
All right, Henry.
So those are my two frustrations.
No problem. And I can understand your frustration with that. And
we share your frustration, believe me.
Absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head with regards to talking about Eaton's. That organization has been around for quite a few years. And who do you talk to about actually getting it removed?
It just seems like common sense has failed, doesn't it? Everybody knows Eaton's doesn't exist, so who are you going to talk to?
Exactly, and unfortunately, I guess their Equifax, their agreements for supplying and I guess downloading information in their credit files are all part of agreements that that are with all the creditors, just not with the Eaton's, and they don't have the authority to change it themselves, and all that information is actually driven by creditors. And if they don't exist, there's really nobody you can talk to have it removed. The interesting thing about your conversation with your bank is if you actually have some bad stuff with your credit file with a bank, it'll only stay on Equifax for 6 years and TransUnion for 7, but they'll keep it active in their files. They can draw information up to 15 years. So I'm not sure how they can't purge that information off your credit file. I've seen banks do some pretty weird stuff on negative credit. I think I'm full of opinions, and this is just another one of them, where I think that in certain cases they take a personal agenda or a personal issue if somebody that they had a problem with and take it upon themselves to regenerate the negative credit file when the 6-year statute of limitation is up. I've seen that happen where all of a sudden it's now stayed on their file for up to 12 years when it should actually only be on there for 9 years. People who have some credit problems, the purge date, as they call it in the credit reporting agencies, is 6 years from the date of last payment. So if you had something on your file for 5 years and then you went in and made a payment on it in the fifth year, it's now going to stay on your file for 11 years. So,
well, in my case, I never had a delinquency anywhere.
All right, you just left it on.
I dealt with two different banks, and both of them came back and said, yes, our files indicate you're paid and there's been no delinquency, but if you're looking about the historical information or what it clears from your file, it'll have to be done by our head office. And I said, well, how do I get in touch with your head office? They said, well, we'll do it for you. And both of them, unrelated banks, came back and said, our head office says we don't have those records and you don't have a problem. And I said, well, please remove it. And they said, we can't do that.
So I think the problem is nobody wants to take the effort to have it removed, Henry. And I've seen that quite a few times as well. Pardon me, where people promise to take care of certain things from credit files, and it does take a lot. We see lots of cases where people have name spelling errors, or people got married or separated and divorced and changed their names, or have an incorrect birth date information because somebody keyed it improperly into a mortgage application or any type of creditor application. And I've been on the phone for 2 and 3 hours at a time trying to correct some of these errors that somebody created, and trying to get old records purged off that nobody's got on their computer systems anymore. I share your frustration in terms of how it got on and the impossible situation of getting it off. Fortunately, in your case, it's not negative information. It's just old information that the majority of people wouldn't pay any attention to anyway. But I certainly concur with your thinking that it would be nice to get it off.
And that was their argument. You know, why are you worried about it? You don't have a problem. And I said, I agree, but it seems like a frustration. Anyway, I appreciate you taking the time to chat to me about it.
No problem. Thanks for your call, Henry, and have a great day.
All right.
Thank you for calling, Henry. So Henry helped help answer the two questions I was going to ask. Is everything on the report true or accurate? Apparently not. And if something is wrong on the report, how do you get it corrected? Well, I guess you ask and hope they'll go, okay. Otherwise, they might just go, nope, sorry, you don't have a problem, leave us alone.
And there are so many ways for inaccurate information to get into your record or old information to remain that is no longer a consideration. You know, from a simple keying error when information's being put in to problems that have been resolved or payments that have been made and debts cleared that... It's nice you've paid the lender off. Mm-hmm. They've received all the money. They're happy with you. But that debt or that trade line still exists. But it's just too much effort on the lender's part to inform the credit bureau that it's gone.
Okay. We've got a minute left. And in that minute, I want you to tell me how we can improve our credit reports so lenders will want us to do business again. And you can also do your rate specials, Kevin. So go.
All right, so go quickly. First of all, there is a significant correlation between credit limits and credit balances. You should never advance more than 75% of your credit limit. That same thing applies on a $5,000 limit as well as a $500 limit. You should never, ever go over your credit limit because it'll negatively impact your credit score in a short term by up to 70 points. It's a lot easier to get bad information on your file than it is to get good information. Keep your credit clean. Make your payments on time. Always make the minimum payments. You can't pay the entire thing off. At least make the minimum payments. Rate specials.
Mm-hmm.
5-year fixed term money, 4.35%. For a 90-day closing, 4.5% with a 120-day rate guarantee. Variable rate mortgage prime minus a half for an interest rate today of 1.75%. 7-year fixed term money at 4.90 and 10-year money at 5.55%.
And if you'd like to take advantage of those rates, well, give Kevin a call right now. Now that the show is done, 519-240-2967. That's 240-2967. My guests, Kevin Power and Ann Turner from Power Mortgages. online at powermortgages.ca. Thanks for being on the show again.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave. Have a great, enjoyable, wet weekend.
I shall indeed. Stick around. News is next, and more of Ask the Experts here on 570 News.